This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. For listeners of this podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/sword. That's audiblepodcast.com/sword.
This podcast is part of the Frog Pants Studios Network. For more information about this and other shows, visit frogpants.com. Audio program so good, it's like you're there.
I'm Veronica Belmont.
And I'm Tom Merritt.
And we are live at Dragon Con. Yay!
Thank you all for showing up. It's great to see such a huge crowd.
Yes, we are super excited to be here. This is our fourth Dragon Con.
Yep.
And I believe we have done four live episodes as well.
We have.
And it is absolutely my favorite con in the world. It is my favorite place. I'm always super excited to come, even though it is 90 million bazillion degrees outside and I'm dressed like a maniac.
Those of you listening to the audio podcast don't realize that Veronica is dressed as a demon hunter.
I am. So any demons in the audience?
Forget it. You're done.
Totally
you're toast.
Totally screwed. But yeah.
I'm dressed up, too.
What are you dressed as, Tom?
Guy from Firefly.
Which guy from Firefly, Tom?
The guy with the blue sun shirt in the background and, you know.
He's just a
extra. I guess if I shaved the sides, I could have been Jane.
You could have been.
I should have bought a Jane hat.
Wasn't there someone cosplaying as you this year?
There was. And he was wearing a blue sun shirt.
Was he?
Yeah.
Is he
blazer.
Here? He's not here, is he? No.
Oh, I don't see him, no.
That's really depressing. He didn't even come to his own podcast.
Or maybe I'm him.
It's an audio podcast. No one will ever know.
No one will ever,
they just
ever
have to take my word for it that it's not an imposter.
All right. Well, shall we talk about what's coming up? There's some good books coming out in the next couple of weeks.
Absolutely. Yes. On the this is the calendar section of the show, by the way, in case you were wondering. On September 3rd, we have Clockwork Angels, the novel by Kevin J. Anderson and Neil Peart. Neil Peart of Rush.
Rush
by
fans.
The way.
I got a few Rush fans.
What's up with that? How amazing.
Yeah.
I love that. I think it makes perfect sense.
September 4th, we'll have to split this up. There's a lot of books coming out September 4th.
Yeah.
The Dirty Streets of Heaven by Tad Williams. Rapture of the Nerds by Cory Doctorow and Charles Stross. Lord of Mountains, Novel of the Change by S.M. Sterling. Slow Apocalypse by John Varley.
Then we have The Spirit Well, Bright Empires by Stephen Lawhead. The Timekeeper by Mitch Albom. And The Blackwood, Strange Chemistry by Gwenda Bond. And Be My Enemy, Book 2 of the Everness series by Ian MacDonald.
September 7th, next week, our video book club kickoff of Foundation by Isaac Asimov will happen. Also coming out on September 11th, 2012, The Blinding Knife, Lightbringer Series Number 2 by Brent Weeks, and The Brides of Roll Rock Island by Margot Lanigan.
Yeah, so we talked a little bit before the show about anyone who is reading Foundation, and can we get another show of hands by that, or who has read Foundation?
If you have read
Actually,
or are reading.
Actually, make a yelling
reading.
Noise instead, because
yeah.
This is, of course, an audio podcast, so
none
the show
of, you
of
are
hands
here.
Thing doesn't work quite so well in that kind of format. But yeah, we're really excited about it. We just shot, we did shoot the opening episode for that, for the video show,
yep.
Which we're excited about. And we just wrapped up Assassin's Apprentice by Robin Hobb, also a great one of my personal favorites. Did you guys enjoy that pick? I love Dr. Horrible Guy in the front row is like, he's going to be listening to the show later and like, that was me. I was the loud guy that everyone could hear. No, thank you. I appreciate your you know.
Make it your ringtone.
Get-goativeness.
Oh, that's me screaming. had a really cool show.
Yeah.
This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with over 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers and almost every book we read as a Sword and Laser pick. Listeners of this podcast, including all you people here in person, can get a free audiobook if you haven't given Audible a try. Go to audiblepodcast.com/sword. For instance, you can get the Orc King Forgotten Realms Transitions Book 1. Get started on some R.A. Salvatore for free.
Yay!
So try it out. And if you're like, look, I've been an Audible subscriber for 100,000 years. This is not doing me any good. Pass it around. Give it to a friend. Somebody who hasn't tried Audible, tell them audiblepodcast.com/sword, and they'll get a free book, and they can try it out.
Absolutely. So we're going to do one more check to see if our guest has joined us. No dice? All right. Well, contingency plan.
We may be joined by R.A. Salvatore at some point.
At some point. We're really hoping.
No,
either that or we'll just have to do
some
more.
We can tell you when, but it would be a spoiler.
We can do the invisible chair. What's the meme that they're doing on Twitter now? What is it? The Clint Eastwood. But there's a hashtag for it. It's like, it's Eastwooding. Yes, it's when you talk to a chair. Oh, I think, is this our guest?
No, okay. Would you like to be?
So close.
Just trying to talk random people into it.
Oh, Bill Doran is here. He's my costume designer. Bill. Hi, Bill. He is our guest. I was right. Ha-ha. Thank you for joining us. How's it going?
Well, I got through the Skywalk somewhat alive.
Uh-huh. We figured it was a little hard to get around out there right now. Just thanks for joining us, man.
Good to be here.
I'm Tom, by the way.
I'm Bob.
Nice to meet you.
Veronica, would you like us to call you Bob?
Yeah.
Okay. Fantastic. Well, and congratulations on being the guest of honor here at Dragon Con
this
year.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. That parade was amazing.
Yeah. I missed the parade.
I've never experienced anything quite like that before.
Yeah, because you were in it, right?
Yeah, I was riding a Mustang. Very nice.
Ooh.
Mustang.
Yeah.
Wait, how was that canon?
It was black.
Okay. I'll take it. So, of course, for all of you who may not know, Mr. R.A. Salvatore is the author of many wonderful trilogies, including the Dark Elf trilogy, the Hunter's Blade trilogy, and many, many, many more. For people who haven't read your work before, what would you recommend as a good kickoff book?
Well, I would say if you wanted to read about the Dark Elf, I would start with Homeland, personally. That's still one of my favorites. And then for people who probably aren't as hardcore in science fiction fantasy, and I would say The Highwayman.
Nice.
Yeah, I like that one.
That's saying something, because you've got, what, 53 or more books?
Something like that.
Yeah.
I don't even know anymore. Some of them are only half books, like the Tarzan novelization and the Star Wars novelization. And you don't really write them. You're like a mechanic.
Yeah, you crank them. They just come printed out of your mouth.
No, they give you a script and yell at you if you stray too far.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, I don't really know the process of what it's like for a writer to work with an existing series or an existing canon.
It depends on the series. I remember I got the call to do the Star Wars novelization for Attack of the Clones, and I had already done a Star Wars book. Anyone in here know that one? Yeah.
Yeah?
And it was kind of an interesting experience. Because after I signed the contract, they told me I had been hired to hit the Wookiee.
Mm-hmm. Spoiler alert for anybody who really, really cares. But yeah,
So Lucas wanted to hit the Wookiee, hired the Italian, we hit the Wookiee.
Yeah.
And that was tough. So then they said, we'd like you to do the Attack of the Clones novelization. And I was like, I don't know. And then,
do any Wookiees die in this?
No, but you wouldn't believe how many people wrote to me and said, I'll forgive you for killing Chewbacca if you kill Jar Jar in the
I think that's fair. That's
Were you tempted? They wouldn't have let you get away with it.
Oh, they don't let you get away with anything with Star Wars. But it was really interesting because I flew out to Lucasfilm to Skywalker Ranch. There really is a Skywalker Ranch.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
It's amazing.
As well.
I kept hiding in closets, but they kept finding me and kicking me out. And I was up there on the night of the election in 2000.
Oh, wow.
And so it was the most surreal day of my life, I think. I got the script, and I was back in my room, and I'm watching TV, and every time I finished the scene, we had a different president. Remember that one? Florida for Bush, Florida for Gore, Florida for Bush. And it was, like, very surreal. And the next day, I had a nice meeting with George for several hours, which was really cool. We were supposed to talk for 45 minutes, but I discovered that when you get George Lucas talking about Star Wars. The time flies. So I wouldn't leave. And we had a great time. And then what happens is you get the shooting script, and, you know, I say, where can I push the parameters? Where can I go? And, you know, we go back and forth on a couple of things. And I start writing, but then I have to stay really agile because as they're shooting the movie, they're changing things. And what really blew my mind is when I was done the book, I went back. The book came out 2 weeks before the movie. So I was back on tour, and I was back at, I actually went to Skywalker Ranch as part of the book tour. And they, do you want to see the director's cut of the movie? You know, the cut? And it's, I'm like, well, yeah.
Yeah, duh.
And so I went in there, and I'm watching the movie. I'm like, yeah, I got that. And going on and on and on and on and on. And then I get to the ending, and it's like this 25-minute war with the clone army. And I'm reading, and I'm like, I'm dead. Because none of that was in the script.
They didn't give it to you.
And so it was the first time since I've been writing that this happened to me, but I got a whole bunch of emails from people saying, boy, you can't write a battle scene. Save your life.
You of all people. Yeah. Get that email. That's ridiculous.
That's incredible.
You know, speaking of battle scenes, and for those who don't know, he writes a lot of really good battle scenes. I have read on your Wikipedia entry, so I always want to find out if it's actually true, that you were a bouncer.
Paid my way through college.
Does that inform? It seems like a logical jump that would inform some of those battle scenes.
Yeah, I played hockey. Yeah. That was the start. And then, when I was trying to get my way through college, I worked in a plastics factory, and I worked in a nightclub, and I was a bouncer for about 4 years.
And where was this?
In central Massachusetts, a club called the Cinema Lounge, which was, what a trip.
Yeah.
We used to have happy hour on Friday night. We put 1,300 people in there, four bouncers.
Wow.
Do the math.
So you really have written out your battle scenes based on that, it sounds like.
Without the booze, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you want to read the first user question?
Yeah, we got a bunch of questions from folks on our Goodreads forum, and we'll start off with one from Mike. It's a longish question, but he says, I love the collection of short stories surrounding the Drizzt series you've written over the years. Of particular note, the story about Wulfgar as an old man. Given that Wizards jumped their official timeline ahead for 4th edition, essentially forcing Forgotten Realms authors to do the same, do you wish you could have gone back and done things differently with the stories that were prematurely forced to come to an end?
Okay, get me in trouble on the first question. two parts to that. First, that short story anthology, it's called The Collected Stories of the Legend of Drizzt, came out about a year ago, a year and a half ago. It was an incredible experience for me because I had to annotate it. So I had to go back and look at, reread all the stories and say, you know, what was on my mind, what I was trying to get across when I'm writing the stories. And what was really cool about that is as I read the stories, it threw me right back into the time and place and mindset of when I wrote the stories. Because I don't go back every year and read all the Drizzt books. I wouldn't have any time to do any writing if I did that. But this threw me back over the years, like the first story that was the first notch, Brunner story that I did in Dragon Magazine in like 1989, okay?
Cool.
And so what I realized as I was doing that is that it really put this whole job of being a writer, this whole career, into focus for me. Because since that time, I had this epiphany that what I'm really doing here is this is like my life's journey. And all I'm doing is, as I go through different phases in my life, I'm creating these characters and putting them in situations and throwing things at them and looking for their answers. And it's almost like I'm talking to myself. You know, I don't write the books for you guys. but for me. And that really crystallized that. Now, as far as the other part of the question, yeah, 4th edition was thrust upon us, and I had a little Bible. I was on a plane on my way out to Gen Con. I think it was around 2006, and they told us what we were going to love. They weren't asking us what we were going to do. They're like, here's what we're doing. You're going to love it. And I read it, and I went, oh, boy, we're screwed. And I went in there, and I went in a meeting with Ed Greenwood and a couple of other people. And when we left the meeting, Ed Greenwood and I looked at each other, and I said, he says, what are we going to do? And I said, well, we're going to be smarter than them. We have to now figure out ways to outsmart game designers. And that was kind of the mission we went on. The 100-year jump really hurt. I mean, it took me right out of things I was just starting to explore and kind of threw them under the bus.
And does that mean you can't go back and do that?
Well, the thing is, whenever they're doing a brand new thing with a company like Wizards of the Coast, I mean, I can do whatever I want, but it won't be in the Forgotten Realms because I don't own it. Whenever you're doing anything with a company like that, and they're unleashing this brand new edition of the game, brand new this. They don't want you to, the books are supposed to introduce the new world. So they weren't going to let me go back and write that Jarl Axel Zaknafane book like I wanted to. They weren't going to let me do any of that stuff. I had to kind of be with them in the new... And it, you know, it causes problems because 140-year-old humans don't fight well. So
they haven't figured that part out yet.
Yeah, but there were a bunch of us. We're sneaky. We're authors. We work alone, and we're very sneaky. And Ed and I, and we figured out a long time ago things that we needed to do and where we expected this to go. And, you know, things are different now. They really are different at Wizards. Their entire attitude about what they're doing with the new edition of Dungeons & Dragons that's coming out, 5th edition, is really, instead of telling anyone what you're going to love, they're asking people, what do you think? And so we had a summit up there, and it was me and Ed Greenwood and Troy Denning and Paul Kemp and Aaron Evans and Richard Lee Byers and then all the game designers. And we were saying, okay, well, given what we want to do, what would happen in the world that would make sense? And so it all came from us. And it was that was one of the best creative summits I've ever been to in my life, and I am super excited. So much so, and I guess I can say it now, is that starting next year, there'll be 2 Dark Elf books a year for the next several years.
That's fantastic.
The next one's already done. Yeah, the next one will be out in March. It's called The Last Threshold.
Excellent. And a somewhat related question, Derek from the forums wants to know, I'm curious about your take on writing in a pre-established universe. Is it more frustrating to work within a set of confines like Star Wars or Forgotten Realms, or does it relieve you of some of the pressures of completely designing a world?
Well, first of all, designing a world is what makes this job fun, so I'll start with that. But it depends on the world. With Star Wars, yes, you're relieved of all of that. You're even relieved of most of the characters who will be in your book, because they are going to be Luke and Leia and all the gang. In Forgotten Realms, you really are able to find your own place in the world and hide away from everyone else. Like, I created 10 towns. I created Benzo Baranzan. You know, that was my contribution to the map. We were all adding our little pieces. And then, again, with the whole shared world thing, a lot of times it depends who you're working with at the time in terms of who's coordinating the world, who's doing game products that go along in the areas where you're doing your products. And as long as it's respectful and everybody's paying attention to each other or staying out of each other's way, it's awesome. Because little things, I'll give you a perfect example. When I was writing the second book way back in the late 80s, I had to go from the Sword Coast inland. And doing a travelogue is really kind of boring, usually for the reader and the writer. And I noticed there was this one little town along the way called Long Saddle. So I got out my gray box set of Forgotten Realms, and it had this one paragraph entry on Long Saddle. It said it was ruled by a family of eccentric wizards called the Harples, who lived up on the hill in the Ivy Mansion. That's about all it said. And so that kind of got the wheels turning. And I came up with all these kind of interesting characters, and I called Ed Greenwood, who created the realms when he was 8 years old. That's true.
No kidding.
He's amazing. Wow. I love Ed to death. And I said, Ed, I got an idea for Long Saddle. What else you got on? He said, not much. I said, well, what do you think of this? And I read him the chapter. And he was howling, and I was howling, and I knew I nailed it with the Harples. And so when you're doing that, instead of trying to stay out of people's way, what I was doing at that point is I was standing on the shoulders of a giant in Ed. And when I did the Dark Elves, I was standing on the shoulders of Gary Gygax and Dave Arneson. And, you know, those are pretty tall shoulders. So you got a great leaping off point. That's when shared world is great. There are times shared world is not so great, but we try to keep those to a minimum.
Yeah. Well, it's a leaping off point or a falling off point.
Yeah, exactly. And what was great was when I did this new series, the Neverwinter, it was trilogy, now saga, because the March book is part of it, so there are 4 books in Neverwinter. Basically, what they said to me, and this is the way it's supposed to work, they said, are you going to be anywhere near Neverwinter when you do your next series? And I'm always in that area, because Luskin's there, the Sword Coast is there, I'm always over there. I said, sure, I can be there. And they said, well, there's a new Neverwinter Nights game coming out, and we need some things we need to have done there. Can you slip them into your book? And I said, well, it depends. What do you want me to do? I said, well, basically, we want you to blow up Neverwinter. I said, sign me up. I finally get to blow up a city in the realms. And that was a blast. And so the cake of the book, yeah, literally, the cake of the book, you know, the actual story that I wanted to tell, the emotional changes that the Dark Elf was getting foisted upon him because of his new companions, that stayed the same. But the icing became the destruction of a city, which was very cool. I love doing that stuff.
It sounds like what you're saying is that the trend now is to bring authors more into the process and saying, look, we've got professional storytellers on the payroll. Let's include them more. Is that true?
I wouldn't call it a trend. I would think it's almost always dependent upon who's running the show in whatever, you know, licensed property you're talking about. But licensed properties have become big time now because with 150,000 books being written every year, you know, everybody and his brother and sister self-publishing books, it's really hard to break authors out. Like, I'm glad I got in when I did, because it's almost impossible to break new authors out today. So they go to the licensed work. And that's why you're seeing so many more franchise books. People are latching onto worlds as opposed to new authors or authors at all. They're latching onto worlds, which is...
Do you think we're maybe at risk of having science fiction and fantasy run into the same problems we see in movies, where it's just, let's stay in the worlds we're familiar that work?
No, I don't think that's as big a problem for a few reasons. One, you'll always have, they'll always find a new breakout series. Right now we're on Game of Thrones, right? Mm-hmm. And then it'll maybe Patrick Rothfuss is next up. I mean, his books are selling tremendously, brilliant books.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, who'll do the next big movie? Will it be a Dark Elf movie or a Dragonlance movie or something? Who knows? But there'll always be another one coming along. And the thing of it is, you know, I think a lot of people will say, well, you know, it's all becoming the same. It's all becoming the same. But not really. What's happening is that there's a comfort zone that's being built in fantasy. It doesn't mean you're stuck there. But it means that, you know, if you're going to have elves mining in deep holes and dwarves dancing under the stars, your readers are going to go, huh, and they're just not going to like it. Mm-hmm. So you're kind of stuck with the broader archetypes. But writing books is all about characters anyway. I mean, I don't care if I'm writing about a dark elf or a surface elf or a halfling or a hobbit or a human or whatever. They have to be human. People have to relate to that character or you fit.
Yeah.
And that's the difference between a good book and a bad book. And, you know, the trappings, the settings and all of that, you know, they are what they are. World of Warcraft is a lot like Guild Wars, is a lot like EverQuest, is a lot like Conan, you know, the game Conan, is a lot like whatever.
Yeah, it goes down the line. Speaking of characters, and I'm sure you get this question a lot, but Chris wanted to know about your inspiration for Drizzt and why a dark elf.
True story. I had sent the book to TSR. It was TSR then. It's before Wizards of the Coast. I was asked. They couldn't put that book out. They said, we like what you've done, but there's a book called Echoes of the Fourth Magic, first book I ever wrote. We like what you've done, but we only have room on our schedule for a Forgotten Realms book. Can you write one? Or can we turn this one into one? They said, what are the Forgotten Realms? They weren't out yet. Uh-huh. So they sent me the only printed material they had in the Forgotten Realms. And that was a book called Dark Rock or Moonshade by Doug Niles. Wonderful book. And I read it, and I'm like, I'm going to love this world. But the map in that book had these little Moonshade Isles. And they were tiny. And that was it. That was the map. And so I'm like, kind of a small world. And I didn't really want to write a sequel to Doug's book. So what I did in my audition is I wrote a chapter called Bigrin's Lair about the hero of my book, Wulfgar, and Darith from Doug's book going into a lair of firbolgs and wiping them out. Well, I got this phone call, and they said, oh, we can't do that. You know, we don't want you to, you know, write a sequel to Doug's book. And I'm like, I don't either. They go, but, you know, this is a small place. And they go, oh, we don't want you on the Moonshade Isles. And I'm like, looking at the map. I'm like, you want me in the water?
You know? Where like, am I going to go?
Oh, we never sent you the maps of the realms. So they sent me the Ed Greenwood's original maps of the Forgotten Realms. They had copies, copy paper, 8.5 by 11 copy paper, a stack about that thick. No numbers, no key. Some of them were just a line with a tree. And I'm like, oh, this is going to be fine. I was working in finance at the time. So, you know, finance, white, long sleeve, white shirts, ties, hair over the ears, the whole, I mean, really. So one day my boss and his boss and his boss are all going, come on, we're going for lunch. I've got too much work to do. And as soon as they left, I took all the furniture out of my office and slid it into the hall. And I got down on the floor. I took off my tie, tied it around my head like a bandana. And I'm on the floor, sleeves rolled up, trying to figure out this.
I want you to have a knife in your hand.
It's a good thing I didn't, because I would have killed myself when all of a sudden behind me I hear, what are you doing? I had lost track of time. There's my boss behind me. And so I turn around, and there are these three guys in charge of this like $30 million service department. And they looked at me, and I explained what I was doing. So they all took off their ties, tied them around their heads. And the four of us get in there, and we finally figured out the realm. So I called Mary Kirchhoff back, the editor, and I said, okay, I've got the maps now. Let's put the book here. And she go, oh, that's Cormier, and that's Ed's place. We're going to leave that for Ed. It's his world. Okay, great. I want to be here. Oh, no, that's Callum Shannon. You know, we've got people writing there already, and, you know, Doug's got the character from there, so we're kind of like, okay, I want to go here with the glacier. That'll work perfectly for what I have. Oh, no, those are the Bloodstone lands, and we're doing a module series. And this went on for 2 weeks. And finally I said, you know, I've got this world that's the size of Eurasia at the time, right? I mean, it's gigantic. And I finally looked at it, and I saw these mountains, and it looked like a typo. I said, see that little typo up there between the sea of moving ice and the spine of the world? Is anyone there? She said, no. I said, well, there's 10 towns. Leave me alone. I promise I'm getting to your question. I just had to set it up for you. So I think nothing more of it. I send in all the stuff. You know, I've now got the book, and I'm getting ready to write, but I'm still working. So I'm at the work one day, and the phone rings, and it's Mary Kirchhoff. Remember, this is before cell phones. This is 1987. In fact, this past July was the 25th anniversary of when I started writing The Crystal Shack. Yeah. How about that? 25 years. Always blows my mind that most people coming to my books are younger than the book. That's bizarre. But anyway, so Mary calls me up and she goes, we got a problem. I said, well, what's the problem? She said, well, I'm going into a marketing meeting. I've got to sell your book to the Salesforce. This is critical for a book. But you can't use Dareth. I said, I don't want to use Dareth. Let Doug use Dareth. She goes, yeah, but that's the chapter I have. I need a sidekick for Wolfgar. Says, all right, well, I'll get back to you next week, and I'll come up with something. She goes, no, I'm going into a meeting, and I need a sidekick for Wolfgar. I looked at the clock. It was like 11 o'clock. I said, all right, I'll tell you what. I won't take lunch. I'll work through lunch. I'll come up with a character for you. I'll call you this afternoon. She said, no, you don't understand. I'm late for a meeting, and I have to sell your book to the sales force, and I need a sidekick for Wolfgar. And I'm like, uh-oh. I said, a black elf. They were called black elves, man. There's a long pause. This is a drow. And I said, yeah, a drow. Now I'm thinking. A drow ranger. I said, a drow ranger, that'll be cool. It's a drow ranger. I said, yeah, a drow ranger, that'll be cool. I said, no one's ever done that before. I said, Bob, there's probably a reason. No one's ever done that before. I said, no, a drow ranger. So we went through this for a little while, and finally she said, all right, well, since it's a sidekick character, I'll let you get away with it. What's his name? And I swear, give me a Bible, I'll swear on the Bible, I'm not even religious. Off the top of my head, I said, his name is Dritz de Warden of Dermen Shesbanon, the ninth house of Menzel Berenzon.
And how did you remember what you said?
She reminded me. Okay. No, but she said, what? I said, I don't know. She said,
hope you got that.
She says, can you spell that? And I said, nope. And it didn't matter. He's a sidekick character. So I started writing the book that weekend. And the first chapter, I've got him running across the tundra. Dritz running across the tundra when he gets jumped by Yetis. And I knew on page 2, this isn't Wolfgar's book. This is his book. Like, who is this guy? And that's how it happened. It was no one I had played before, no one I had in a game, we didn't even allow Dark Elves in our game. You know, no one I had ever thought of before. It just happened. It was really weird. And, you know, 33 books later.
Yeah.
And I remember a couple of years later when I wrote The Halfling's Gem, I'll never forget, there's another one TSR said to me. Well, tie up everything in this book, because we're going to go on to different characters. People are sick of these characters. That was 1989. But that's how it happened.
That's incredible.
I guess there is magic in the world.
So I'm changing gears a little bit, but I think since we've already let the Wookiee out of the bag, it's a good question. What is your feeling about killing off a major character, and how has that response been for you?
Well, if you've read my Demon Wars books, I can be as bloodthirsty as George Martin, which is pretty bloodthirsty. But as far as that character goes, it's my only regret as a writer.
Really?
I would not do it again. I absolutely would not do it again. I found out about it.
It wasn't your choice, obviously.
No,
it's
what
not
happened
really
was
you made.
I was working for Del Rey at the time. I was doing my Demon Wars books, and they got in this incredible bidding war between Del Rey and Bantam for the rights to the Star Wars books. Studios. And these rights were heating up because there were going to be three more movies coming out. And so they got in this huge bidding war, and the price just went up, 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 and up. And what was really funny is right after Del Rey won it for like tens of millions of dollars, right after they won that contract from Bantam, the company that owned Bantam bought the company that owned Del Rey.
Show them.
And they wound up a floor apart in the same building. So you think that the people up top, before they gave Lucas all that money, would have said something, but no. But anyway, they told me what they were trying to do with this new Jedi Order series. Introduce the new enemy and this whole arc of the Yuuzhan Vong, this new enemy and what they're trying to accomplish. And basically my job was to come up with a story that would go from point A to point C on an A to Z scale or something. And I had certain beat points I had to hit. And they told me they wanted all the characters in the book, which killed me because I had to have everyone from the movies and everyone from the Young Jedi Order, Young Jedi Academy or whatever, and Mara Jade, who I didn't want to touch because that was Tim Zahn's character and, you know, so tightly tied with Tim. I didn't want to go near that. But anyway, and then I turned in my outline and I was on a phone call with Lucasfilm and Del Rey, and they said, this is great. This outline's great. This is just what we wanted. But didn't anyone tell you? You have to kill Chewbacca.
And you're all like, no.
Yeah. I noticed there are kids here, so I won't tell you what I said back. But it wasn't nice. But I talked to Mike Stackpole and Jim Lucino and some of the other people who were involved in it. And it was coming from on high. And it's his galaxy far, far away, not mine. And they all convinced me that we were doing it for the right reasons. And so I agreed, as long as I could do it the way I wanted to do it. And it was really, that's my biggest regret as an author. I when I've seen the reaction, some people are like, this is cool, now I'm on the edge of my seat again. But there are other people, I've had 45-year-old guys come up to me and say, and just burst into tears because they used to sleep with a Chewie doll. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's like, I did that.
Yeah.
It's going to be on my tombstone. He killed Chewie, the bastard, you know? So I have people who still, like, I've had people come to book signings. My friend was going to come, but he doesn't want to talk to you. He hates you.
Aww,
forever.
And it's so much harder knowing that it's not your fault either. Like, you
well,
didn't,
I pulled the trigger.
You did, but...
But on the other hand, though, all these characters have to die at some point.
Says who?
And, yes. We may not have to know about it, but they, you know, they're not immortal, or maybe they are. But you said you were convinced for the right reasons. I mean, can you? What are the right reasons for killing a major character like that?
They had said after, you know, hundreds of books and thousands of side products that people had become so complacent that there was no tension left in the books. And I think that's probably true. Not the Wookiee, man. Not the Wookiee. Kill Luke.
I'm curious who would have preferred that.
Anybody?
Really?
All right. Good, pretty good sized Luke contingent for the killing. The Luke killing contingent.
I picture them going to George's office with like this hit list. Which one, George? Kill the dog.
So IO9 has a great article up asking several authors what their biggest writing setback or stumbling block was and how they overcame it. So how would you answer that question personally?
Do I want to even say that, get into that? Yeah, it's, all right, you know what it is to be a writer? What it is to be a writer is to know with certainty that no matter how many letters you get from kids saying, I never read a book until, no matter how many letters you get from people who may be fighting cancer, who are saying they're finding hope and inspiration in your characters, no matter how many times you hear from a kid who says, I never had any friends in high school and your books were my friends and Dritz was my friend. No matter how many letters you get from a soldier in Afghanistan saying, you know, I thank you for letting me forget what I had to do today and what I'm going to have to do tomorrow. No matter how many awards you win, no matter how many bestsellers you have, no matter how many parades you get to sit on the back of a Mustang in, no matter any of that, and especially in the age of the internet, to be an author is to know with certainty that there is always going to be someone more than happy and willing and excited to shout out to the entire world how much you suck. Okay?
And the megaphone just keeps getting
bigger. And this really just started coming into play beyond belief around the time that book came out that we were just talking to. Now, I have to set this up. I had to cancel my book tour for that New Jedi Order book, Vector Prime, because the day I was supposed to be at the World Trade Center, Borders, this was in 1999, so it was still there, to start the book tour was the day my brother, who was my best friend in the entire world, was having his last MRI, where they basically said, we can't do anymore. He had pancreatic cancer. 19 months of hell. But anyway, so I had to cancel the book tour. My brother passed away a couple weeks later. The book came out. Death threats started coming in. Hate mail started coming in. For, I would say, about 2 years, and I'll be honest about this, I would go to places like Amazon.com, and I would look for one-star reviews to feel the pain of them. And the reason I was doing that, it took me about 2 years to figure out that the reason I was doing that is because I couldn't actually face what was really bothering me, which was the fact that I just lost my best friend in the world. It took me about 2 years to get past that. That was a rough, rough time. And the way I got out of it was just by going through the natural grieving process and getting past that, which you go on with your life. But also, that book that I wrote at the time when he was sick, a book called Mortalis, the fourth book of Demon Wars, was my catharsis. And I went back and took a look at that again, and it got me through it. It's hard for me to explain to people, you know, this whole fame and fortune deal. Keep the fame. Send me the royalty check. It can be such, you know, to read in the Washington Post that I had to cancel my, the Washington Post, I had to cancel my tour to stay home with my dying brother, who no one in the family knew was dying at that point, except for a very few of us. Was pretty tough. So that was definitely, sorry to bring you all down to the convention, but I'm over it, so you should be too. So that was tough. And I've actually been asked to bring other authors under my, when we see young authors coming up and they're all happy and they get their first book published and eight of their friends go and give them 5-star reviews and yeah, and nobody knows them yet. And I'm like, keep your feet on the ground and be ready. And then the assault starts. Yeah. So that was my biggest stumbling block right there.
Thanks for being willing to share that with us, by the way.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure we have many fans who would not leave you one-star reviews in the audience today who would love to ask you some questions if you have some time for that. And if you ask a question, we will also give you a Sword Mixer t-shirt if we call on you and ask your question. So if you want to, should we pass the mic around or should they come up? Come up? Okay.
Come on up to
there's
the
a microphone
mic
up here.
Over here on the side.
So if you have a question for Bob or for us, please come on up and ask it now.
And Becca has the t-shirts over there.
She left her t-shirt cannon at home, so she's just going to throw it really
she
hard.
She seriously
right
has
face.
One, though. We wish she would have brought it.
No questions. We can leave.
No questions? Yeah. About?
He's got armor on. It's just going to take a minute.
It's just going to take a while. Yeah, you guys can ask us questions about the show or about books or anything that we've been reading or anything you want to read or comments or that is a lovely suit of armor.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Yours is not too bad either.
Thank you.
Hi, Mr. Salvatore. Thank you for coming out. Huge fan of your books, of course. I think pretty much everybody here can say that. But I was wondering if there's a world that you want to write in that you've never been asked to write in that you would or just like burning up to write about.
Yeah, there was a world called Amalur.
You know what I have to say? I liked where that story was going.
You can't even say that because 2006, I get a phone call. I'm sitting at home, and the phone rings. Now I'm living in Massachusetts. I'm part of Red Sox Nation.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. We got beat 20-2 last night.
Go Giants!
Sorry.
So
I'm sitting at home. And, you got all our players now. Good luck. And the phone rings, and I pick up the phone, and the guy on the other end says, can I talk to Bob Salvatore? And I said, speaking. And he goes, oh, man, I can't believe I'm talking to you. My favorite author. This is Kurt Schilling.
Yeah, buddy.
And bloody sock guy, right?
Yeah.
And so I'm like, yeah, screw you, you know? And I'm looking over, and my wife is laughing because his publicist had called earlier. And so I finally figured out it really is Kurt Schilling calling me. And I'm like, wow, I can't believe I'm talking to you. And he's like, I can't believe I'm talking to you. I'm like, I can't believe I'm talking to you. This went on for 20 minutes back and forth. And he told me he was getting ready to retire, but he didn't want to go sell used cars or anything. And what he really wanted to do was start a video game company, and would I come in and create a world for him? And so I did. And there's a world called Amalur. And I had this incredible team that, first I had my own Dungeons & Dragons group that I got together because I only had 2 months to do all the research and get it. I had this idea that I can't even talk about now because it's in bankruptcy court and the state of Rhode Island will shoot me if I say anything. I had this idea that I thought really kind of culminated everything I've pulled out of fantasy in my life, as you know, what it's done for me and enriched my life. And I had this idea to kind of bring everything together in one place. And I wasn't sure it was going to work or not. And I brought it in and I showed the narrative team. And everybody got on board. And the art team got on board. This was in 2006. And we spent the next 3 to 4 years building a 10,000-year history of this world. And I did the first 5,000 years and with help. And then the narrative team spread. And then I guided them on the next 5,000 years. And then we purchased a company called Big Huge Games from a company called THQ. And they were doing a single-player RPG. And so they built an engine for it. We took our art assets and put it on their engine, and it worked beautifully. And they came out with a game last year called Reckoning. And in Reckoning, my job, I didn't write the story for Reckoning. Everyone thinks I did. No, I did not. That credit, and it's some of the story writing in that is brilliant. It's that credit goes to the narrative team at Big Huge Games. They were amazing, and they were wonderful, and I just love that team. My job was to listen to their ideas for the various storylines and bring them into the bigger world, find ways that we could help connect it. It was me and two other guys who were really in charge of the intellectual property at 38 Studios. We would sit down with this team and just help coax them over to some of the themes we were trying to hit. Because the whole point of doing this world was the philosophy behind it, as much as anything else. Like, it's not enough. We were making an MMO, a World of Warcraft type game. Now, in an MMO, you know you're going to come back when you die. Okay, I'll just give you an example of how we thought about Amalur. You know you'll come back when you die. That's a given in an MMO, otherwise no one would play. You spawn naked in the city and got to go get your corpse in EverQuest. You spawn in the graveyard in Warcraft, and your ghost has to go back to your corpse. So we wanted to add a little twist to that. And so that's the first level. You know you're coming back. And so we came up with something called the Well of Souls. And this is kind of explaining why you're coming back. But anyone can do that, right? That's easy. You can just come up with a name for something. That's the second level. And then the third level is the Well of Souls was developed over 5,000 years by the gnomes for a specific reason that made sense within the world. That's the third level. And then the fourth level is, this is where I really challenged the narrative teams. I said, what would happen in this world if all of a sudden they had an immortality machine? Because that's what we've got. What does that mean? Well, everyone would be happy. No, that's not what it means. Think about it. What happens to the church whose entire power base is predicated on an afterlife? What about all those people who are fabulously rich and powerful at the head of the church who are suddenly nobody needs them or wants them anymore? Are they going to be happy about it? They may use their money to buy it, but are they going to be happy about losing their power? What about the mother who lost her son and now is aging and is just waiting for the day when she can pass on because she believes that she's going to see her child again in the afterlife? Is she going to want to go through the machine? What about what kind of emotions might the last person whose child or husband or wife or mother died right before those things became active, what might they be going through? And this is what Amalur was all about. So we had all these people arguing and going to different levels, further and further. And what you saw in Reckoning, I can't even, everyone says it's a fate-based world, and no, it's not at all. That is a slice this big of a pie, a time and place this tiny to what we had. And the whole thing is under lock and key. And it's killing me. Because I had a prequel book I was going to write. I got short stories I've written there. And they're all in a vault in Rhode Island.
Well, all right. Well, thank you very much for answering my question. I definitely appreciate it. As a bit of research for your next book, Plate and Gamberson is miserable in subtropical environments. Don't do that to your character.
Do you want your t-shirt?
Clink, clink.
That is one clanky outfit.
Hi, Bob. How you doing?
Doing all right.
I'm a big fan of your work, and I started off with the Icewind Dale trilogy probably about 96 and just ate it up and loved it. But I think the biggest thing that has always caught me about your books has been that you set up such a hatred between Drizzt and Jarlaxle. And where did you get that? Where did that come from? Was there something in your life that set that up?
Oh, no. God, no. except for a couple of Chewy fans. No. I don't think Jarlaxle ever hated Drizzt. I think a lot of people did in his society. But whenever you're doing things like that, what I try to do is I want to know my characters. I don't know my characters when I start writing about them. They tell me who they are. And then I let them keep talking. Because I don't think anyone gets up in the morning and says, oh, I think I'll do evil today. You know? So if I have a bad guy, an Adamus Contreras, for example, there has to be something, there's a reason. I don't want just the psychopath. Occasionally you get the psychopath who just likes to blow things up. But by following those characters along, and remember, you're only intersecting with them. A lot of times if it's the tertiary characters, like Jarlaxle will bounce in and bounce out, right? And same with Intrary in the early books. Whenever they come back, I want to know where they've been and what they've been doing, and why they're back. When I look at characters, I'm always looking for why they're doing what they're doing. I'll be writing a story, and this happens to me all the time. I never know what's going on the next page. Okay, I write an outline, I start writing, I throw the outline away. And I let the characters take me on an adventure. And sometimes I see the characters doing something that's really weird, or developing this real hatred for somebody, like you talked about. And instead of saying, oh, they can't do that, and erasing it, you know, hitting control alt delete or whatever, I say, why are they acting like that? And they tell me. And I don't think Jarlaxle hates Drizzt at all, but if you've noticed in the more recent books, he got really mad at Drizzt when Drizzt stopped being Drizzt, which I thought was very cool, because that's when I learned a lot about Jarlaxle that I didn't know after 23 years. You see?
I see.
They tell me.
That's fantastic. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
I want, before we have you come up in the green shirt, the woman in the Love Nerds shirt, I saw that you were here before any of the other people were in line, so go ahead. We had a little confusion, so if you have understanding, go ahead and let her jump in front. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Salvatore, for coming, and I know earlier you talked a little bit about new writers, and you talked about the amount of books being published and self-publishing, and I wanted to know, I know that you could probably talk forever about this, so just one bit of advice for new writers, or the best advice.
The first thing I tell every writer, that everyone tells me I want to be a writer, is if you can quit, quit. No, I'm not trying to be funny. If you can quit, quit. Because if you can quit, you're not a writer. Writers can't quit. This is as much a curse as a blessing. You get stories inside you clawing at your skin to get out. And the writing part of it has to be what's important to you. When people think, and I encounter people like this all the time. I have a great idea for a book. I'm going to write a book and make all this money and be famous. And it's like, that's just not the way the world works. The writing part, every day you wake up, you have a term paper due and you haven't started it yet. That's what it is to be a writer. And so you better love the writing. So if you can't quit, you're over the first hurdle. More practical advice, when I got my first rejection letter, I talked to Robert Cormier, a guy from my hometown. Wrote I Am the Cheese, The Chocolate War, brilliant young adult novelist. And his phone number was actually in I Am the Cheese. That was his actual phone number. So I called him up. He didn't know me, but he had spoken to one of my classes when I was in high school. And he kept me on the phone for like 3 hours. And what he basically told me is character is more important than plot. I never thought of it this way before. He said, but you can have the best plot in the world, but if you have lousy characters that nobody cares about, the book fails. But if you have characters that people care about, you give them a hangnail and they're on the edge of their seat. So I think character is more important than plot. And I think most beginning writers tend to get hung up on having this amazing story with all these twists and turns. Even complicated worlds like Wheel of Time, A Song of Ice and Fire, the storylines aren't that complex. When you really get down to it, it's just characters, human nature taking over and people doing things people do. Right? So character more than plot. And then the third thing, which is just most basic, write every day. You have to write every day. There's no such thing as writer's block. Writer's block is lack of confidence. If you have that, get out now. Sit down and write. I don't know what I'm going to do. Start hitting the keys. Something will happen. You may throw it all out tomorrow, but at least your mind is being forced back into your work. And then when you're done, for God's sakes, read it out loud to yourself. I mean, Hotel Hilton Room Crystal Ballroom, time Saturday, 2:30 p.m. Because when you read it like that, what you're doing is you're reading it the way a reader, with the approximate speed that most readers will be reading it. You will catch H-T-E, right?
Yeah.
You will catch tot-he, which is the one that the spell checker doesn't catch, instead of to the, right? Tot-he. You will find, if all of your sentences have the same structure, that you are going da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and you'll be bored out of your mind, and you'll change sentence structure. And you will find sentence fragments that are kind of, how did that get in there? It makes no sense. Read it out loud to yourself.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And thank you for allowing us to correct that. We only got 5 more minutes, so...
I'll be quicker, I promise.
A couple more questions.
I write novels. What do you want?
People like to pigeonhole writers because of the genre they write in, but I always like to ask, what sort of authors or book series do you read outside of your genre that interests you?
Oh, I love reading... Michael Schara is a favorite, and now Jeff Schara, the Civil War history with Schara. The Killer Angels, I think, is one of the best kind of history books I've ever read, even though it was fictionalized, but it really wasn't, based on Battle of Gettysburg. James Joyce. If you ever get cocky as a writer, read the last 4 pages of The Dead out loud. You shall be humbled. It's brilliant writing. I wish I could write like that. And I like reading a lot of the bloggers today. I think 2 in particular, just for the writing, Ta-Nehisi Coates and Matt Taibbi, just for the writing, even when I completely disagree with them, okay, and want to go punch them in the mouth, they're brilliant writers. And you see a lot of that out there. So I spend a lot of time reading those because I don't have time. I can't sit down and read novels the way I want to because it interferes with the writing and I'm always writing. So I have to kind of really pick and choose the novels I want to read. But
thank you.
All right. Next question. Come on down.
First of all, about a month ago, you did a podcast interview with my friends and I on CD Game Review, so that was like the highlight of my life. So thank you so much for
that.
You
need to get out more.
That's probably true. That's probably true. But anyway, you know, you've created a lot of iconic characters, you know, not just in the Dritz universe, but also in the Demon War series. But if you could go back and pick a character that maybe you didn't get to explore as much at the time that you were writing, or maybe isn't as appreciated by the fans, which one would you go back and choose?
Well, actually, that did happen to me. It was character Brother Francis in Demon Wars. In the first 3 books of Demon Wars, Demon Wars really takes place, the centerpiece of it is the church. And so I need monks. I have these monks all over the place. And, you know, I've got my main cast of characters, but it's a huge book. Demon Wars has 100 different storylines going on. So I needed kind of like, you know, the extra in the high school play monk to come in and say one line here and one line there. And that was Brother Francis. Whenever I needed a monk to come in and say, the boat is here, master, it would be Brother Francis, because I couldn't keep coming up with names, for one thing. And then I started writing that book, Mortalis, that I talked about. And all of a sudden, as I got about 3/4 of the way through the book, I realized, oh my God, this is Brother Francis's book. And it was really subtle and quiet. And I went back and I looked at the evolution of that character, and it blew me away. And I had never expected that to happen. So, Brother Francis, absolutely.
Very cool. Thank you. And if I go back to any character, it'd be Oliver the Burrows from The Crimson Shadow, my right. Highway half.
Yeah, do that. That'd be yeah. Great. I would read that.
Oliver DeBarrow's The Highway Halfling is a cross between Inigo Montoya from The Princess Bride and the little French guy on the wall in Monty Python and the Holy Grail. I love Oliver.
Nice. All right, we'll squeeze in one last question.
So as a writer, you obviously, you mentioned that you don't get to read much, but I was wondering from all three of you, what are the books, the probably one for each, I guess I'll have time for, that you're most anticipating upcoming, just getting to read, even if it's an older book, just something you are going to get to read soon.
Oh, Red Country, Joe Abercrombie, is the one that's nearest to being released coming out that I'm looking forward to.
The one I'm most anticipating reading is probably Cloud Atlas, which I'm looking forward to a lot. You're starting on that?
I already started that one.
Well, for me, it's actually a book that's already out, but I haven't gotten a chance to read it yet. I had heard that Terry Brooks was putting Shannara together with his Night of the Word stuff, running with the Demon books, and I want to see how he did that because I love his Night of the Word books. So I want to go read that. And then the other book I really want to read again is A Canticle for Leibowitz by Walter Miller, which is like my second favorite book of all time, behind The Hobbit.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, well, thank you so much for joining us.
It's great to be here.
All right, Salvatore. And if you want to get in touch with us, our website is swordandlaser.com. The email address is feedback@swordandlaser.com. And make sure you check out the show on Geek and Sundry on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/geekandsundry or the audio podcast, which you can find on iTunes or at swordandlaser.com. We'll see you guys next year.